I want to welcome everyone tonight, it's wonderful to look out and see such a large group of people. But I want to thank you for coming out tonight to the third reading in our inaugural series, fall writing series, for the Center for Poetry in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities at Michigan State. I want to start off by again saying thanks to Dean Steve Esquith and to the faculty and staff and students of the Residential College who have really come out to support the Poetry Center in its short lifetime, and special thanks to the Program Planning Committee of the Poetry Center, who are the ones you see doing all the work in the back, selling the books and providing the food, and I want to thank them for their hard work and their commitment to this endeavor. And I also want to make a short announcement for those of you who would be interested. The Writers Club in the Residential College is hosting tomorrow night at 8 o'clock an informal chat and conversation with Carolyn. And if you would like to come to that and get a chance maybe to talk about some of the topics about poetry, the responsibility of the poet in the world today, the relationship between poetry and art, and other relevant topics, we will be at 8 o'clock outside the Aurora Borealis coffee shop in Snyder Phillips. There's a lounge area over there, and we'll just be over there, and we'll be sitting around talking, and if you would like to join us, that would be wonderful. With all that said, and no more alarms, it gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce to you Carolyn Fouché for many reasons, some personal and some professional. Who better to represent the juncture of art and civic engagement, two cornerstones of the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, than a woman who has traveled around the globe to bear witness to political and cultural struggles and returned to use the craft of poetry and sometimes prose to acquaint us all with situations we should know about, events we should discuss, actions we should take on behalf of humanity. Margaret Atwood has said that the job of the poet is to evoke, and whether Carolyn is writing about the loss of a childhood friend from Detroit, Michigan, or the disappearance of thousands of men and women in El Salvador, she is able, through her incredible command of language, to evoke in us the same sadness and horror felt by the narrator of the poem. Most of you know the long catalog of prizes, fellowships, and awards Carolyn Fouché has won and that she is currently teaching at Skidmore College. You may not know that she grew up in Detroit, Michigan, that she is a graduate of Michigan State University, a graduate of Justin Morrill College, a forerunner of our own Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. Incredibly, she spent her senior year living in Snyder Phillips Hall, the home of the Residential College, and is eager to see it after its recent transformation. It would be easy to use all the time allotted Carolyn for her reading to praise her publications and accomplishments. Instead, I will close this introduction by simply sharing a passage I read last night from the introduction to Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, which we all read every night before we go to bed, I know, where he tells the reader what it takes for a poem to be great. I would tweak that passage a little to say that it is what it takes for a poet to be great, and this is what we get in the work of Carolyn Fouché. And this is Whitman's quote. To be a great poem, this is what you shall do. Love the earth and sun and animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and the crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons and with the young and with the mothers of families. Read these leaves in the open air every season of every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any books. Dismiss whatever insults your own soul, and your very flesh shall be a great poem. Carolyn Fouché.
Thank you so much for coming. I went to school here. I graduated 35 years ago. I worked in this building. I lived in Snyder Phillips. I'm one of those Justin Morrill alumni, alumna I am, and very happily so, and very proud of it. And I'm really, really pleased that you have a residential college in the arts and humanities now, which I think of as a second life for Justin Morrill. So I want to thank Dean Steve Esquith and Anita Skeen for all her hard work in bringing me here, and to tell you that 36 years ago, I met Diane Wachowski in Vermont at Breadloaf, and she invited me to come mushroom hunting with her and with Maxine Cumin. And Maxine Cumin was actually going to eat these mushrooms after we picked them, but I walked through the forest thinking, I'm hunting mushrooms with Maxine Cumin and Diane Wachowski. I'm hunting mushrooms with them. I couldn't believe it. So it was really special. It's very special to have you here and to be back here. I'm really moved to be here again. I know that you've been reading different things. Some of you have read earlier books, so I'd like to begin with a couple of poems from The Country Between Us, and these come from the time when I worked in El Salvador, which was 1978 to 1980. Two poems from the book, The Country Between Us. This section of the book begins with a quote from Antonio Machado. Caminante, no hay camino, se hace camino al andar. This is walker, there is no path, you make the path while you walk. And this first poem is The Visitor. I went into a prison in Ahuachapán. I wanted to make a map of the interior of this prison. So this is written for the person who showed me the inside. The visitor. In Spanish, he whispers, there is no time left. It is the sound of scythes arcing in wheat, the ache of some field song in Salvador. The wind along the prison, cautious as Francisco's hands on the inside, touching the walls as he walks. It is his wife's breath slipping into his cell each night while he imagines his hand to be hers. It is a small country. There is nothing one man will not do to another. I feel, given the times, I should warn you that this next poem has an obscenity in it. It actually has two obscenities, but the Federal Communications Commission only thinks there's one. So it gets beeped now. I was the last person, Noah Adams told me I was the last person to say this particular word on National Public Radio without getting beeped. And I consider that kind of an achievement. I should put it down on my resume, right? The Colonel. What you have heard is true. I was in his house. His wife carried a tray of coffee and sugar. His daughter filed her nails. His son went out for the night. There were daily papers, pet dogs, a pistol on the cushion beside him. The moon swung bare on its black cord over the house. On the television was a cop show. It was in English. Broken bottles were embedded in the walls around the house to scoop the kneecaps from a man's legs or cut his hands to lace. On the windows, there were gratings like those in liquor stores. We had dinner, rack of lamb, good wine. A gold bell was on the table for calling the maid. The maid brought green mangoes, salt, a type of bread. I was asked how I enjoyed the country. There was a brief commercial in Spanish. His wife took everything away. There was some talk then of how difficult it had become to govern. The parrot said hello on the terrace. The colonel told it to shut up and pushed himself from the table. My friend said to me with his eyes, say nothing. The colonel returned with a sack used to bring groceries home. He spilled many human ears on the table. They were like dried peach halves. There is no other way to say this. He took one of them in his hands, shook it in our faces, dropped it into a water glass. It came alive there.
I am tired of fooling around, he said. As for the rights of anyone, tell your people they can go fuck themselves. He swept the ears to the floor with his arm and held the last of his wine in the air. Something for your poetry, no? He said. Some of the ears on the floor caught this scrap of his voice. Some of the ears on the floor were pressed to the ground. San Salvador, May, 1978. Well, I came back from Salvador and worked in anti-intervention sanctuary and solidarity movements. We wanted to stop military and economic aid to military regime in El Salvador, and the aid increased exponentially every year we tried to do that, but we were assured that we may possibly have had something to do with American public opinion about the war in El Salvador, and that at that time in our history, American public opinion may have had some bearing on the government's decisions. So I had to answer. I didn't think I was writing political poetry. I still don't think that's what I was doing. I was writing experientially out of my life and my circumstances in the same form, in the same way I had done before. But I had to answer then after this period for politics and poetry, the relation between the poet and the state, poetry and human rights and so on. So I developed some ways of trying to approach this question. I thought that the arguments were reductive. On the one hand, people praising any poem because it has some politics about it. And on the other hand, people condemning any poem that mentions anything political at all. That was how it was playing out at that time. So there's an anthology. I mentioned this because it's here tonight. I'm like a person who had a disease. Political poetry was my disease. And I went to the library and I read poetry from the 20th century trying to diagnose myself. And I discovered that most of the poets of the 20th century had seen wars or been forced into exile or had been imprisoned outside of the English-speaking world. And so I began to read what they had written in the aftermath. Some wrote explicitly about those things, some didn't. I felt that in some way the language was always marked by what the language itself had passed through. So that became Against Forgetting, 20th Century Poetry of Witness, 145 poets writing from 30 languages and English. And it begins with a motto. It begins with the Armenian Genocide. And at that time, it ends with Tiananmen Square. I thought that after the collapse of the Soviet Union and so on, that the world was now going to be peaceful. So the book was published in 1993. The century was not, as it happened, over. So, you know, I keep thinking maybe I should do a revision, but I can't bear think about doing the revision, so I will just tell you what the mottos are. The first one is from Bertolt Brecht. In the dark times, will there also be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. And when the poems have all had their say at the very end, there's another motto by Bertolt Brecht. This, then, is all. It's not enough, I know. At least I'm still alive, as you can see. I'm like the man who took a brick to show how beautiful his house used once to be. So during that time, I thought about the 20th century, and I was in different countries with my husband. And finally, we wound up in Paris, where I gave birth to a son. A few months after that, I was put in a hospital in the middle of the night for a reason unrelated to the baby, and it was Hotel Dieu, God's Hotel. So I thought, well, that's a good name for the hospital to have if I'm going to be in a hospital in Paris. You want to go to God's Hotel. So then I went in the room, and the woman, my roommate, was there, and she was awake. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And she looked at me, and she said, "And what are you?"
So I said, I'm a poet. And she said, and I am also a poet. So I thought, I'm in God's hotel with a poet in Paris in the middle of the night. This is getting better. I took out my notebook. No, I mean, but the next thing she said was, and I don't speak any languages fluently. So I'd never heard that claim before. And she had good reason not to speak any languages fluently. She didn't like any nationality well enough to speak its language. So I'm going to give you her voice a little bit. One little page from her voice in The Angel of History. Her name is Ellie. And she talked to me for a week in four different languages. And every time she woke up, she started the story in another place. This is Izye during the war. Izye and the neighboring village of Boigné-Courton. This is a farmhouse in Izye. Itself a quiet place of stone houses over the Rhone, where between Aprils, 44 children were hidden successfully for a year in view of the mountains. Until the fields were black and snow fell all night over the little plaque which does not mention that they were Jewish children hidden April to April in Izye near Boigné-Courton. Comment vivent les couteurs? Comment duvet d'oiseau sur ma vitre en hiver? In every window, a blank photograph of their internment. Within the house, the silence of God. 44 bedrolls, 44 metal cups. And the silence of God is God. In Pithiviers and Bonne-la-Rolande, in Les Milles, Les Tourelles, Moussac, and Aubonne, the silence of God is God. The children were taken to Poland. The children were taken to Auschwitz in Poland, singing Vous n'aurez pas l'Alsace et la Lorraine. In a farmhouse still standing in Izye, le silence des dieux est Dieu. There's a poem in here that I want to read. It's from Shukeyen in Hiroshima. There's another woman's voice in this poem too. A woman, I walked through the restored, is that what you call it? Restored garden in Shukeyen. This garden was burned, of course, in Hiroshima in August 1945. And this woman replanted garden. I was there with Galway Canal. We were the nuclear poets from the United States. There were two poets from each of the nuclear-powered nations at the time there, 12 poets in all, six nations. So we were invited to attend the Asian Writers' Congress. And the theme that year was literature under the nuclear cloud. We are still writing that literature. The Garden Shukeyen. By way of a vanished bridge, we cross this river. As a cloud of lifted snow would ascend a mountain. She has always been afraid to come here. It is the river she most remembers, the living and the dead both crying for help, a world that allowed neither tears nor lamentation. The matsu trees brush her hair as she passes beneath them, as do the shining strands of barbed wire. Where this lake is, there was a lake. Where these black pine grow, there grew black pine. Where there is no tea house, I see a wooden tea house and the corpses of those who slept in it. On the opposite bank of the Ota, a weeping willow etches its memory of their faces into the water. Where light touches the face, the character for heart is written. She strokes a burnt trunk wrapped in straw. I was weak and my skin hung from my fingertips like cloth. Do you think for a moment we were human beings to them?
She comes to the stone angel holding paper cranes, not an angel, but a woman where she once had been, who walks through the garden, Shukayen, calling the carp to the surface by clapping her hands. Do Americans think of us? So she began as we squatted over the toilets. If you want, I'll tell you, but nothing I say will be enough. We try to dress our burns in vegetable oil. Her hair is the white froth of rice rising up kettle sides, her mind also. In the post-war years, she thought deeply about how to live. The common greeting, Dozo Yoroshku, is, please, take care of me. All Hibakusha still alive were children then. A cemetery seen from the air is a child's city. I don't like this particular red flower because it reminds me of a woman's brain crushed under a roof. Perhaps my language is too precise and therefore difficult to understand. We have not, all these years, felt what you call happiness. But at times, with good fortune, we experience something close. As our life resembles life, and this garden, the garden, and in the silence surrounding what happened to us, it is the bell to awaken God that we've heard ringing.
Bell. My husband and I were in Beirut during the war, 83-84, and it was the winter when the truck bomb drove into the Marine barracks. 257 American Marines were killed in that explosion. A few weeks after the explosion, I went up to those buildings, the barracks, to walk around for a little while. And the barracks had tumbled, so the walls and the roofs were collapsed, but some of the walls were standing. And on the standing walls, there were drawings that had been made by those soldiers who had slept in those barracks. They made them out of charcoal, and they were drawings of themselves. Some of them were very good. And on the ground, there was still things. Cigarette packages, lighters, little things strewn around everywhere. So I went to write, and some of it came, and then I put it in a drawer for 20 years because I got nervous about it. I got nervous about writing about that right away. So I called this poem Writing Kept Hidden, and I took it out recently. The black fire of ink on paper took hold of their souls, incorporeal fire. There was no protection this fire couldn't touch, nor darkness, nor a moment. It lasted as long as a dream. It was no dream. Heteroglossia of nervous shortwave, cloud of blown walls. In the barracks, those who had sketched themselves in coal and smoke became coal and smoke, and the living remained, linking unknown things to the known. Residue, scapular, matchlight, name on a tongue. Then, for an hour, the war slept, and rain filled the cisterns with silence. Our windows faced east, and on August evenings, the sky was a blue, no longer spoken. I have a little poem that I wrote for my son, the one who was born in Paris. He's now a senior in college. But this was when he was about 14. And so I titled it Curfew. And it's about trying to explain something that can't be explained to a 14-year-old son. The curfew was as long as anyone could remember. Certainty's tent was pulled from its little stakes. It was better not to speak any language. There was a man cloaked in doves. There was chandelier music. The city, transparent, shattered, but did not disappear.
between the no longer and the still to come, the child asked if the bones in the wall belonged to the lights in the tunnel. Yes, I said, and the stars nailed shut his heaven.
So there's one prayer here. There's a prayer poem here, and it's from the first Iraq War. It probably applies to the second Iraq War.
Begin again among the poorest, moments off in another time and place. Belongings gathered in the last hour, visible, invisible, tin spoon, teacup, tremble of tray, carpet hanging from sorrow's balcony. Say goodbye to everything. With a wave of your hand, gesture to all you have known. Begin with bread, torn from bread. Beans given to the hungriest, a carcass of flies. Take the polished stillness from a locked church. Prayer notes left between stones. Answer them. And hoist in your net voices from the troubled hours. Sleep only when the least among them sleeps, and then only until the birds. Make the flatbed truck your time and place. Make the least daily wage your value. Language will rise then, like language from the mouth of a still river. No one's mouth. Bring night to your imaginings. Bring the darkest passage of your holy book.
So I think I'll read a couple of new ones. They're not published. I'm pretty slow. I write a book about once every 10 or 12 years. That's considered slow, by the way, by most people. So, but I can't do any better. This is a small poem, also from Beirut. It was the time of the car bombs, and so this comes from a car bomb. And there was a part of the city, it's referred to here, Place de Maltil. And the Place de Maltil was a part of Beirut that was completely empty and uninhabited and completely destroyed. But you could walk around there. No one was there. You just had to be careful about where you stepped and things.
In the cinema of the Place de Maltil. That morning, they lifted above their heads what appeared to be a doll in a christening gown. And we stood in the cordite haze waiting for water hoses to stanch the fires quickening through carpets and bedclothes. And we did not turn away, nor did we photograph the child, except at the moment of its being raised. But later walked in the Place de Maltil, where a stillness had been created entirely by small arms fire that so blistered walls and blackened shops that no one remained in that part of the city. And we stopped before the ruined movie house that had lost all but its blank screen, where once all manner of figures had shone, wavering, composed of light, their speech subtitled, passionate, inane, with nothing to say to the audience we had become.
So I had a friend. His name is Semezdin Memedinovic. Semezdin Memedinovic was trapped inside Sarajevo during the siege of Sarajevo in the middle 90s. Some of you will remember, some of you may not, but the city was surrounded and the people couldn't get out. So this was for him. It's called Letter to a City Under Siege. Turning the pages of the book you have lent me of your wounded city, reading the braille of its walls, walking beneath ghost branches of chestnuts, fires that turn the bullet-shattered windows bronze, flaring an instant without warming the fallen houses where you sleep without water or light, a biscuit tin of nothing between you.
or later in the cafe that is no longer, you choose the one. Hours of an evening discussing burnt literature from the library where all books meet with despair. I want to give your notes back to you so they might be published in a common language, not yours or mine, but a tongue understood by kindergartners and night watchmen. I want to lie down in the cemetery where violets grow in your childhood, before snipers fired on the city using gravestones for cover. It isn't difficult to sleep among the dead. Before leaving, I want to tell you that your tunnel is still there, mud-walled and hallowed of earth, through which you brought provisions into the city, weapons and oranges, oranges bright as winter moons by the barrow load. I would crawl through your tunnel as you did, leaving some of your violets and the night of your poems. I would bring everyone a gift of pears, then walk further up Abdullah Kauji Street, where one can see the city in fog. Roofs woven of blackened timber filled with sky, uprooted bridge railings groaning in wind, where a shard of glass is suspended as a guillotine over the spines of books in a shop window, and where through snow a dog finds his way with, in his mouth, a human bone. What happens isn't complicated, is it? Nor is the city hell on earth. Shells don't rain down from the heavens, but are fired by human hands. The children of the city make bulletproof vests out of cardboard. There is no shortage of food, water, medicine. Food, water, medicine are withheld. The clopping sounds aren't horses, but roof tiles shattering. There are carcasses of trolley cars and trams, limbless caryatids. The library burns on page 60 as it burns in all the newspapers of the world. Quiet are the ruins of the houses of God. All the houses. And what else? What more? No food, no light, no water. Clocks aren't spared. The tunnel, the oranges.
I don't know what I'm doing. I think I'm going to read you an Ilya poem. I mentored this young poet. His name is Ilya Kaminsky. I met him when he was 19 years old. In a summer workshop, similar to a kind of workshop where I met Diane. And he shows up in the workshop with all the people in the summer. And we gather around, and the first day everyone introduces themselves. And people say, well, I'm a little nervous because I'm going into a Master of Fine Arts program in poetry in the fall. And I'm scared. And the next person will say, I'm just retired from 30 years of teaching, and I've always wanted to write, and I'm going back to it now. This is what I want to do. And 15 people later, it's Ilya's turn. He has huge hearing aids. He's profoundly deaf. He says to the group, my name is Ilya Kaminsky. I am from Odessa, former Soviet Union. I write poetry for God. And I said, okay, class, well, let's look at our poems then. I'd never met anyone who said that before. And then I taught, I was with him for a long time. We even went back to Odessa together. And now he's almost 30 years old, and he has a book out called Dancing in Odessa. But this is a poem for him about exile and his childhood. The city of your childhood rises between steppe and sea, wheat and light, white with the dust of cockle shells, stargazers, and bones of pipefish, city of limestone soft enough to cut with a hatchet, where the sea unfurls and acacias brought by Greeks on their ships turn white in summer. So yes, you remember, this is the city you lost.
City of smugglers and violinists, chess players and monkeys, an opera house, a madhouse, a ghost church with wind for its choir, where two things were esteemed, literature and ships, poetry and the sea. If it happened once, it happened in Odessa. If you return now, it will not be as a being visible to others. And when you walk past, it will not be as if a man had passed, but rather as if someone had remembered something long forgotten and wondered why. If you return, your father will be alive to prepare for you his mint cucumber soup or give you the little sweet called bird's milk. And after hours of looking with him for his sandals lost near the sea, you visit again together the amusement park where your ancestors are buried. And then go home to the apartment house built by German prisoners of war to whom your father gave bread, which you remember surprised you. You take the tram to a stop where it is no longer possible to get off. And he walks with you until he vanishes, still holding in his own your invisible hand. This is, I have a friend who doesn't like to buy things. He's anti-consumer person. And so when he travels a lot, and there are always, you see, souvenir shops and museum stores. The museum stores are particularly difficult because they have nicer things than the souvenir shops. But he decided he was never going to buy some things from his travels. So instead, he picks out a really wonderful stone and he takes it home and puts it up on prongs on a little box and he labels it Stone from Beneath the Eiffel Tower, Summer 1998, or Stone from the Nile, blah, blah, you know. He had bottles of water too, river water and things, but most of them were stones. And he also had a piece of the Louvre. I said, is it okay to have a piece of the Louvre? He said, all the buildings are falling apart. You just have to keep your eyes open. You can always find a loose piece. So I thought, well, this was a pretty good idea. And I thought, well, I'm going to try this. I said, do you mind if I make a stone museum too? And he said, no, it's not my idea. I know other people who do this, you know. So there are many of us, he said. So I started getting these stones from different places. Only I am not an organized person, and I did not go home and put them on the prong and label them. So what I have is a bag of stones from all parts of the world, very important stones. I have no idea which one is which or where they're from, but they are important, and they're all together now in my closet in a bag. So I wish that I had done it differently, but this is called the Museum of Stones. These are your stones. Assembled in matchbox and tin, collected from roadside, culvert and viaduct, battlefield, threshing floor, basilica, abattoir. Stones loosened by tanks in the streets from a city whose earliest map was drawn in ink on linen. Schoolyard stones in the hand of a corpse. Pebble from a Polonaise oui. Stone of the mind within us, carried from one silence to another. Stone of cromlech and cairn, schist and shale, hornblende, agate, marble, millstones, ruins of choirs and shipyards, chalk, marl, mudstone from temples and tombs, stone from the silvery grass near the scaffold, stone from the tunnel lined with bones, lava of a city's entombment, chipped from lighthouse, cell wall, scriptorium. Paving stones from the hands of those who rose against the army. Stones where the bells had fallen, where the bridges were blown. Those that had flown through windows, weighted petitions, feldspar, rose quartz, blue schist, gneiss and chert. Fragment of an abbey at dusk, sandstone toe of a Buddha mortared at Bamiyan. Stone from the hill of three crosses and a crypt. From a chimney where storks cried like human children. Stones newly fallen from stars. A stillness of stones. A heart. Altar and boundary stone. Marker and vessel. First cast, load and hail. Bridgestones and others to pave and shut up with. Stone apple, stone basil, beech berry, stone brake, stone bramble, stone fern, lichen, liverwort, pippin, and root. Concretion of the body, as blind, as cold, as deaf, all earth a quarry, all life a labor. Stone face, stone drunk with hope, that this assemblage of rubble taken together would become a shrine or holy place, an ossuary, immovable and sacred, like the stone that marked the path of the sun as it entered the human dawn.
I have a close with this. It's been, I don't know what time we started, because we started with a fire, right? Or something. Or a bomb scare or something. So I'm not sure, but I have this one, and I have a few paragraphs. I'm working right now on a memoir at Elia's insistence, and in it he interrogates me, and he wants to know everything, what's behind these poems, stuff I never want to talk about. I didn't think I could write something in sentences, but I did it for him. So I think sometimes it's good to try something that you're scared to do. So I'll read you a couple of paragraphs of this. And why I'm reading it is it comes back a little bit to the beginning. It's Ilya asked me about El Salvador. So it is the Ilya of the Odessa poem and the Ilya of writing poetry for God. I will share a little bit with you something different. I began a story once, a fiction I had hoped, but it was very difficult to invent things, so it stayed very close to my experience. Here is some of it. The jeep bounced over the dry ruts of dirt roads through the tin light of early morning. I steadied the bundle on the seat between us as Leonel drove through Colonias, where blue cook smoke already crawled the roofs, and newspapers taped across window openings were being lifted a little. There was the white steam of morning piss above the ditches, steam where each man stood and where the women bunched their skirts to their waists and squatted, not very far from the champas, whose windows were carved into packing crates with machetes, crates that had once contained new washing machines. So the walls read, Maytag, white, harvest gold. The crates had been hacked apart and spliced together, bolstered with scrap lumber, straw, and mud. The roofs were made from drop cloths. These champas were everywhere, their walls fluttering in the least wind, and with the rains they eventually collapsed into the ravines and had to be built again. The ruins of earlier champas draped the palm leaves like wet bedding. Leonel drove with his hand always on the shift knob, watching cars parked against clay walls or nosing out of alleys, any truck with its hood raised, any van which appeared empty but might not be. He knew what to look for precisely. Panel trucks in the early days, with their sliding doors cracked open, and later black smoke-windowed Jeep Cherokees. Once, Ilya, when I was walking along in the city beside Monsignor Uriastre, we saw such a van stop just ahead of us, and men leapt out and grabbed a young student and wrestled him into the vehicle. It was broad daylight, as they say, and everyone in the street stopped and watched, and I noticed that Monsignor Uriastre crossed himself and that certain others in the street disappeared into alleys and shops, and there was a stillness until the van peeled away with such a cry of tires that the sound stayed in the air after the van could no longer be seen. We must pray for that boy, Monsignor Uriastre whispered. There is nothing else we can do. Years later, in my house in Washington, D.C., when my son was a toddler, I would have long talks with one of the men who had participated in these abductions.
Human rights activists had brought him to Washington because he wanted to tell the truth about his life, to confess what he had done, and to implicate American military advisors in his crimes. His name was Alex, and while I understood the importance of his testimony and his need to stay in a respectable house in a quiet neighborhood, and I often sensed the depths of his contrition, my husband thought his eyes looked dead. Nevertheless, he stayed with us. He taught my son to play chess, a game he had been taught, he claimed, when they were training him for military intelligence. It was something that calmed him down. Alex had thick black hair and gold-rimmed front teeth. He was grateful for whatever we gave him. Iced tea, chicken, sliced papaya, for the extra blanket, the guest room, for waking him when he needed to get up and get ready to go to Capitol Hill again, with us or with other people. And he'd come back in the late afternoon tired. And if I hadn't gone with him, I'd ask how it went. And he would look at me as if he couldn't imagine how to answer me. At night late, I would hear him talking into the tape recorder he had been given. He suffered from insomnia, and when I woke during the night, he was usually downstairs sitting in a pool of lamplight on the couch, leaning over the coffee table with his notes and command charts, talking to himself or into the machine. Sometimes I talked with him, but more often he would say that he wanted to tell the machine everything, and then we could listen. On one tape, he tried to talk about himself, but he found that difficult because he was genuinely bewildered by what had become of him and found it difficult to connect his boyhood with his present circumstance. Click. I was born on the 21st of September, 1962. My pseudonym is Alex. I'm from a middle-class family in El Salvador, and because of that and the times, I took refuge in military service. They promised me a very special training for special work, intelligence work. I was to join an elite group, they said, and I was proud because of it, proud before my father, and of what my intelligence had made possible for me. The training we received was very precise, very specific. At first it was about codes and code breaking, and then about surveillance techniques, and by the time it was about interrogations and disposing of people, it was too late. Click. Ilya. My son was only 3 years old that autumn and was too young to play chess. Nevertheless, Sean would bring the board and pieces to Alex and ask to play, and usually Alex played with him, moving Sean's pieces for him as well as his own. He was playing chess with himself. Our unit was ordered to dispose of people after their interrogations were finished. I always looked at the faces of the interrogators, the face of Corporal Alvarez, the face of Sub-Sergeant, codenamed Eduardo. The prisoners were dirty and thin and had been given blows. They were not in good physical shape. They were run down. In some disposals, we took them to the beach and tied them to dynamite so their bodies would explode and scatter on the rocks near the sea. Ilya, if this is too much, if you don't want to hear it, I'll stop. This is why I don't like to talk about El Salvador anymore, now that I am often far away from the fear and dread of those times, now that these events are considered to be in the past. When I go back there in memory or in dreams, it isn't as if anything is past. It is as if time is nothing. So I close with a poem now. It's called What Comes. It's written in the last year. I had an interesting year this year. I brought back from despair a basket so light that it could have been woven of willow. René Chau. This body was a flock of gulls over open sea, its cries those of hunger entering clouds. There were thoughts of flight through luminous gorse, but a chaos of crows darkened. One discovered within herself the power to free herself. One stepped away from her body, but remained. Years have passed between these moments. There is nothing that cannot be seen from here. How did you know, solitary, that I, who am without clarity, was about to speak? To speak is not yet to have spoken. The not yet of a white realm of nothing left, neither for itself nor another. A no longer already there, along with the arrival of what has been, light and the reverse of light, terror as walking blind along a breaking sea body in whom I lived. The not yet of death itself, darkening what it briefly illuminates, an unknown place as between languages, back and forth, behold, beheld, breath to breath. A calm in the surround rises, fireflies in lindens, an ache of pine. You have yourself within you, yourself, you have her, and there is nothing that cannot be seen. Here is what I think, to be exposed to the coming of what comes.
Thank you. I'll take any kind of question from this group because I'm kind of home now, you know. I feel like, okay, now I'm really here. It felt strange. I felt like a ghost on this campus for the first few hours today, but I don't feel like a ghost anymore. Yes, sir.
You had no hesitation in reading the kernel tonight, yet I've heard that you did not want to include that in your second book.
Well, I didn't think it was a poem.
Why not?
Because I wrote it to be part of a future memoir that I never did write, actually, or maybe I'm doing it now. But you see, it got mixed up in my manuscript. It just got in there. And then this man named Dr. Daniel Albright, who teaches, he's a Yeats scholar. He was teaching with me, and I showed him my manuscript because he had a PhD and had done his dissertation on Yeats, and I wanted his opinion. And he told me that he really, really liked that poem. And I told him that it really was not a poem since it was prose and since I had planned to use it for something else and I had just written it so I would remember all the details. And he said, oh, you're wrong. It has to stay in the manuscript. So I thought, see, I don't have a PhD. I mean, I don't have one. So he did. I thought I would listen to him. I don't usually listen to people, but I did listen to him, and I left it in there. And it did get me in a lot of trouble, that poem, you know, because it was a controversial poem, as were all the Salvador poems. They were all controversial at the time. You weren't supposed to write about those things, apparently. Anything else? So I don't know whether it was right or not. Is all right? Okay. Yes?
Has it been anthologized? Often I saw it in my granddaughter's
I get desperate emails from kids all over the United States saying, I have to talk about your poem tomorrow in class. Can you help me? So I have a standard thing I send to them, you know. But one time, the best one was, I was living in this townhouse in Rockville, Maryland, and my son was about, I don't know, 10 or 11, and a bunch of kids came up to my front door, some of whom knew him, and they said, are you the lady that wrote the ears poem? And I said, yeah. And they said, ew, and they ran away. So I don't know how they saw it, but it's in a lot of places, yeah. It's been anthologized a lot. Probably is my most anthologized poem. I think so. I think it was people read it, or especially in those years, you know, when with Central America. I don't know. You know what they say? They say if you write a poem out of something what they call topical, that it won't last. Because when the event is over, then the poem won't have any power anymore. So I just read that in a book that I'm reading right now called Lives of the Poets. And I underlined it and put a question mark after it. Yes?
For your writing poetry, is it any more difficult today in the context of the Iraq war and thinking? Is this context affected language or writing for you at all?
You know what was, I can't write about this Iraq war. I mean, I can't sit down and decide to write something. You know, this is very difficult. I've always just written whatever could come, you know. It hasn't been because I sat down deciding to write about something in a certain way. So I got that message about the poets against the war, against the Iraq war, the anthology, and I tried. And I thought to myself, what are you doing? You never do this. It never comes when you do this. This is stupid. And so I couldn't write the poem. You know, I couldn't write a poem for it. The other part of your question probably has to do with psychological effects of these things coming around again. I think it affects everybody in that way. But I'm writing a lot right now, new poems and the memoir, so I feel an urgency. I feel a shortness of time, which is, and I may have to do with me rather than the world. I hope it just has to do with me. But yeah, I feel I have to work now, so I'm doing it despite being troubled by events. Yes.
How do you think about rhythm and sound?
Well, I hear the cadences. I don't write metered verse. I did when I was a kid. But I hear a line. Line matters to me very much. Cadences of the lyric cadences within narrative or breaking, rupturing narrative and hearing those cadences. So I read them aloud to myself all the time. And I can tell if it's off, you know, for me anyway. It's very important. And I memorize a lot of poetry, and I recite it to myself, other people's poetry often. I think it schools your ear to memorize poetry. You start to learn different cadences and different rhythms, and so I've done that since I was a kid too. And I actually know most of my poems by heart, but I'm too chicken to go without the books and the paper. So I don't recite them. Yes, but I make my students recite. They have to recite. Yes.
Is the cadence different if it's
like
a subject and
liner? Oh, yes. There are meters that are really wonderful for nursery rhymes. And, you know, there are light meters and light cadences that trip along in a very, you know. So, you know, some people play against that, you know. They use a lighter cadence to darkly write something. Like Bertolt Brecht has something called the primer, war primer or something, in which he uses a very tripping meter and very simple language, like a children's primer, to talk about very dark things having to do with, you know, what happens in war. Something like, war assures us he will take up very little of our time, you know. And then it says something, there was one line he had something about, I can't remember. I can't remember right now because I'm nervous, but I've seen a lot of these. Yeah. But, you know, so you can play against it, but I think it often is very difficult to do that. Yeah. Yes, in the back. Uh-oh. Okay. Okay. Oh, Michigan State. I was here between 1968 and 1972. Do you guys know what went on here in those years? Well, we lived in tents out on the lawn in front of the administration building for quite a long time. Those were fun nights. We weren't in the dorms anymore. And we weren't going to leave. And we were feisty and we were angry. And they had mined the waters of Haiphong. We were very urgent about that. So it was very intense at times here. And there's a big myth that U of M had all the radicals and all the anti-war people, and it's not true. This place did. And the people came from U of M here. I know this. I was here, and also I went to U of M. And, you know, they were sort of surprised by that. But Michigan State was a hotbed of anti-war protest. Can you picture that? I mean, it was amazing. It was really a joyous time, really wonderful. And Justin Morrill College was fantastic. You know, we were so intense. You know, we stayed up all night talking every night. I don't know when we slept, but it was amazing. I'm so glad you have a residential college again. Because it just was like a community. There are about 650 of us, alumni, I think, and we're scattered all over the world, and we run into each other once in a while. A lot of them are overseas. We're all weird. We're all doing strange things. Well, not all of us, but enough of us that the experiment worked. You know, what they were doing here, it was really, really great. You know, now, I would tell you more about those times, but I don't think I should say too much more than I've already said, but you can use your imagination. Yeah. And it was an amazing, it was a terrible time to be in college, and it was an incredible time to be in college, you know, and it's a bad time to turn 18, you know, 1968. Remember what happened in 1968. Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the Chicago, convention. I mean, Detroit, well, that was 67. So, but it was a bad time. It was a bad time to be 18. So I was a little bit young, you know, for it. But it was a great education, a great education. And it stayed with me the rest of my life, you know. And I think that was a lot due to being a Justin Morrill, not just out there in Tent City, but as part of Justin Morrill, you know, because a lot of the radicals from that time aren't doing too much anymore about any of that. But not Justin Morrill, kids. We're still feisty. We're still doing things. So, yeah, okay, thank you so much.